Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. It was born in 1792 when a small group of New York brokers decided they needed one. Today it's an economic powerhouse second to none. We're speaking about Wall Street, which is the subject of a new book by our guest this week, John Steele Gordon. Talking History's Fred Nielsen will be speaking with John Gordon about the history of that venerable institution. And following our visit with Mr. Gordon on a related topic, the world of business, Douglas Brinkley will offer us his thoughts on the life and accomplishments of Henry Ford. But first, Joyce Gidmore takes us back to an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on February 28, 1982, the art world was rocked when the J. Paul Getty Museum received $1.2 billion, making it the most richly endowed museum in the world. The benefactor was John Paul Getty, the American oil billionaire who died in 1976. Even after the construction of the museum and arts education complex in Los Angeles, the endowment was worth $5 billion in the year 2000. The Getty Center, which opened in 1997, includes a museum, library, art institute, arts education center, a museum management school, and a grant program center. John Paul Getty was born in 1892. Accumulating his wealth by buying up oil companies, he developed a passion for collecting works of art. He opened his first art museum in a wing of his home, but when he outgrew that, he built the Getty Museum in Malibu, modeling it after the Villa dei Papiri, which had been buried by the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in the year 79 A.D.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, Charles Murray's new book, Human Accomplishment, The Pursuit of Excellence in the Arts and Sciences, 800 B.C. to 1950, is causing a stir. At a moment of considerable East-West tension, when the phrase clash of civilizations has rarely had greater currency, Murray has issued a global assessment of human achievement, in which Europeans like Shakespeare, Beethoven, and Einstein predominate, and in which Christianity stands out as a crucial spur to excellence. Equally provocative, he maintains that the rate of Western accomplishments is now in decline. As I write, it appears Europe's run is over, Murray asserts. In another few hundred years, books will probably be exploring the reasons why some completely different part of the world became the focus of great human achievement. So now is a good time to stand back in admiration. What the human species is today, it owes to an astonishing degree to what was accomplished in just half a dozen countries, Murray continues, by the people of one small portion of the northwestern Eurasian landmass. And some mummy sellers have been busted. A senior Egyptian official and six other government employees have been arrested for trying to sell a mummy to an undercover police officer posing as an antiquities dealer. The seven were all employed by the Egyptian Agricultural Ministry, and it's believed that they excavated the mummy illegally at a dig 60 miles south of Cairo. This is Talking History. The Great Game is the story of the rise of Wall Street to become a world economic power. It was written by our guest this week, John Steele Gordon. In his conversation with Talking History's Fred Nielsen, professor of history at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, Gordon tells us about the creation of the securities market, the impact of the crash of 1929, the origins of the Dow Jones, and more. He spoke to Fred from his office in New York City.
According to my guest, John Steele Gordon, Wall Street, now 350 years old, is not unlike ancient Rome. Wall Street, like Rome, Gordon says, started small and inconsequential, but circumstances, politics, technology, and sheer dumb luck caused it to grow, to conquer its neighbors, to deal successfully, if often painfully, with its internal conflicts, and finally to emerge upon the world stage as a power that other power centers could ignore only at great peril to themselves. The story of this rise, there's not yet been a decline and fall, is one Gordon tells in his book, The Great Game, The Emergence of Wall Street as a World Power, 1653 to 2000. Mr. Gordon, welcome.
Good morning.
Let's begin at the beginning. What was Wall Street like in the 17th century?
Well, it didn't exist until 1653 when Peter Stuyvesant built a wall to protect New York City. New York City, by the way, is the only major American city ever to have been walled. And behind the wall, Wall Street came into existence. And by the end of the 17th century, it was a sometimes muddy, sometimes dusty lane.
Rather inconspicuous start, it would seem.
Very inconspicuous start.
Things begin to change, though, and by the late 18th century, the United States exists, and Alexander Hamilton, the first Secretary of the Treasury, is doing things that help create, you suggest, Wall Street as a securities market, or help lead to that. At the same time, you also blame Jefferson and his party for allowing that market that Hamilton helped create to be unregulated, and in the process, exposing the country to financial disaster again and again.
Well, Thomas Jefferson hated banks and hated commerce. I mean, his utopia was a land of yeoman farmers. And, of course, the tides of history were moving strongly against Thomas Jefferson at the time and towards the world that Alexander Hamilton envisioned. And in the first time there was a panic on Wall Street in 1792, Hamilton, as Secretary of the Treasury, was able to take actions that confined the panic just to Wall Street, so the only people that were hurt were the traders themselves, who were caught on the wrong end of the problem. But the banks and other institutions remained safe. Jefferson was absolutely just cackled with glee when this happened, and he calculated, because Jefferson loved to calculate, it cost about $5 million, which was the value that he put upon all New York City real estate at the time. So he said this panic was, you know, the equivalent of having the entire town burned down. And Jefferson was obviously delighted with this. And when the Jeffersonians came into power, they just stopped. They got rid of the central bank. So the United States was the only major country in the world to have no central bank for about 80 years. And so there was no mechanism to regulate the market or to protect people when there was a market panic. And in fact, the next time the federal regulatory authorities actually intervened to stop a panic and did so was 1987, when the crash of 87, which most people don't even remember anymore because it had no subsequent consequences.
In the same year that you mentioned, in 1792, a small group of New York brokers signed the Buttonwood Agreement, which you describe as the informal start of the New York Stock Exchange. Who were these men, and what were they trying to accomplish?
Well, they were brokers. They were not yet stockbrokers. They traded in almost everything, in commodities, in insurance, in lottery tickets, and also securities, which are now becoming on the market because the federal government and the state governments were issuing bonds and banks were opening up and selling stock. And these group got together and signed this agreement to give preference to each other and not to charge less than a certain commission. Today we would call this a combination and restraint of trade. But it evolves over the next 30 years into what is today called the New York Stock Exchange.
That arrangement becomes formalized, as you say, in 1817. How did that more formal arrangement work in the early 19th century?
Well, in 1817, they adopted a constitution, which was largely lifted from the Philadelphia Stock Exchange, which established a regular organization with presidents and, you know, members and rules and what have you. And this was the start of what was then called the New York Stock and Exchange Board. Not till 1863 did they change the name to the New York Stock Exchange, but it was a very different kind of institution than what we have today. I mean, members were regularly blackballed, or would-be members were blackballed, because they didn't want the competition. And also, they didn't have an auction market. They had a sit-down every morning and every afternoon. The president of the exchange would call out the names of the securities, and people would make offers to buy or sell, and then they'd go on to the next security.
They were sitting down, and that is the origin of the phrase, the seat on the stock exchange, right?
That's exactly right, although the seats actually disappeared in the 1870s.
So they have to stand up after that?
They had to stand up, right.
How does the Civil War change the stock market?
The Civil War changed the stock market by making it many, many, many times as big, because there was an enormous influx of government bonds. The national debt was $68 million in 1860. By the end of the Civil War, it was $2.7 billion. And this made Wall Street the second largest securities market in the world after London. And it had been a sort of a small, you know, almost informal affair. I mean, regulation was accomplished by social pressure, by peer pressure, because people who got too far out of line, they'd find that nobody would trade with them anymore. But as the market got much bigger, that no longer worked well, and there was no regulation to speak of because the the stock exchange didn't have the power to enforce its own rules, and the judicial system was utterly and totally corrupt at that time.
I'm curious about the process of New York's rise to financial power, not only in the United States, but also later in the world. There are other cities who, it seems, what might have been equal competitors, Boston and especially Philadelphia. How did New York get a leg up on them?
Well, New York got a leg up in two ways. Philadelphia had been this financial center of the country. That's where the first Bank of the United States was established, and it had a bigger financial market than New York did. But in 1837, there was the first really great panic on Wall Street and every other stock market. And Pennsylvania had issued a lot of state bonds, about $20 million worth, and its banks were holding much of this state paper. And Pennsylvania, in fact, went into default. It couldn't pay off its bonds. And the banks in Philadelphia were crippled. New York, on the other hand, had only about a $2 million state debt, and it could easily handle that. And so the New York banks were in a much stronger position, and over the next few years, New York was able to become the dominant financial center. And then the telegraph came along. 1844 was when Samuel Morse, you know, typed out "What Hath God Wrought." And within 10 years, the whole country was wired with telegraph. And suddenly, people who had been forced to trade in their own local market, like Philadelphia or Boston or Cincinnati, they could now trade in New York over the telegraph. And the largest securities market always offers the best prices for both buyers and sellers. And so people, of course, wanted to trade where the prices were best. And so the money just flowed in through the telegraph lines into New York. And by 1850, New York was overwhelmingly the dominant market.
Well, you make the point a couple of times in your book that a market can never be larger than the area in which communication is, for all practical purposes, instantaneous. We think of the Internet accomplishing that now, but the telegraph seems to have done something of that sort back in the 19th century.
Very much so. The Internet has made the market even larger today. I mean, you can be, you know, sitting in your villa in the Fiji Islands and trade in New York.
After the Civil War, Wall Street in the 19th century seems to have been dominated by a chicanery of wild characters like Jay Gould and Jim Fisk. They're the people who show up in textbooks. Are they typical of the stock market?
No. They made the best newspaper copy, of course. And that's why, you know, the person who's not involved in day-to-day Wall Street always tends to think of Wall Street as being a bunch of crooks, because the crooks are the ones you read about in the newspapers. But actually, you know, 99% of Wall Streeters are, you know, they go to work in the morning and they come home from work at night and they run an honest business. But the crooks always get the attention.
Where did the Dow Jones Average come from?
The Dow Jones Average came from the Wall Street Journal, in which Charles Dow, one of the founders, had this really brilliant idea. He wanted to have a way of assessing how the market had done that day. And so he selected 15 stocks. It later went up to 30. And he would, at the end of the day, he would tote up the price of all, each of those stocks, divide by 15, and come up with the average. And that way you could assess how the market itself had done rather than the individual stocks. And this was the first time it had ever been done. And it was 1896. And the first thing that happened was the Dow Jones Industrial Average promptly went straight into the tank.
Better not to know sometimes. Well, does that mean that prior to things like the Dow Jones Average, that investors were flying, if not totally blind, at least with blinders over one eye?
Well, they had to do it sort of in their head, you know, rather than get this regular figure. You know, so they were able to, you know, they knew what, if the market was going up or the market was going down, but they didn't really know how much. This gave them a much more precise way of looking at it. It's also invaluable for historians.
The greatest down, of course, is the crash of 29. Was that crash inevitable? Could it have been possibly avoided?
Well, no crash is inevitable, and it could, all crashes could be avoided in retrospect. The great tragedy here was a man named Benjamin Strong, who was the governor of the New York Federal Reserve and effectively the head of the National Federal Reserve. And he had pumped up interest rates. He saw that, you know, things were getting a little out of hand. And unfortunately, he died in the fall of 1928. He had tuberculosis. And for the next 5 years, the Federal Reserve was essentially leaderless. They just did nothing, because most of the other governors of the 12 Federal Reserves were political appointees who didn't know much about banking or money. And so after, you know, in the spring of 1929, people started, you know, when the bubble really took off, banks were lending money at enormous interest rates. They were lending it at 7% to brokers who were lending it to their clients at 12%. And they were, it's just, you know, it just got, they were, the whole bubble was financed with this borrowed money, so of course it all came crashing down.
The crash doesn't cause the depression, but they follow, it follows very quickly on its heels. How did the crash and the depression affect Wall Street?
Well, of course, the Dow Jones Industrial Average on September 2nd, 1929 was 381.17, and the fall of 1932 it was 41, a fall of about 90% in value. And also the volume greatly decreased eventually. It was very high, actually, in the early days of the Depression, but later on it fell dramatically. In fact, during the Second World War, brokers sometimes played baseball on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange for lack of business.
The chairs are gone. for much of its history, Wall Street seems to have been a place for the brave or the foolish few who are willing to bear the enormous risks, at least they could be enormous sometimes, of the game. When did it become a place for the masses?
Well, the man who invited the masses in and who made an enormous fortune in the process was Charles Merrill, who was the founder of Merrill Lynch. And until then, brokers dealt mainly with wealthy individuals. And there were very few mechanisms. The first mutual fund was invented actually in the early 1920s, but they were a very small part of the market. There was no real mechanism for investors of modest means to invest in the market. And Charles Merrill just completely changed the way Wall Street worked. I mean, Merrill Lynch was founded in 1940. By 1950, it was the largest brokerage house in the world by several orders of magnitude. And all other brokers had to follow along just in order to compete. And suddenly the little guy was much more important than he had been before Charlie Merrill came along.
I wonder if there was something to overcome there, too. Some Americans all along have looked upon Wall Street as a den of gambling. Jefferson might have seen it that way, I suppose. Were those people right?
You can certainly gamble on Wall Street, and people do it every single day. I mean, the day traders who sit there staring at their computers, you know, buying a stock at 10 minutes past 10 and selling it at 13 minutes past 10 are gambling. But there are lots of other people who are investing, who buy stocks and hold them for the long term, and anybody who has done that over the long term has made money at it.
In what sense has Wall Street been, and in what sense is it still now, a world power?
Well, it's the beating heart of world capitalism. And as we've seen, you know, any number of times, when Wall Street sneezes, the world catches cold. And it's still very much that. It's, you know, the market itself is moving into the ether. I mean, NASDAQ, for instance, does not even have a trading floor. It's all done by computer. But still, it'll always be called Wall Street. And also, you know, an awful lot of Wall Street takes place over lunch. You have to meet people to do real big deals and stuff like that. And so there'll always be a place where you need to do that, and that'll probably be in Lower Manhattan for the foreseeable future.
Well, Mr. Gordon, thanks so much for visiting with us.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with John Steele Gordon, the author of The Great Game, The Emergence of Wall Street as a World Power, 1653 to 2000.
. 2003 marked the 100th anniversary of the Ford Motor Company, and to coincide with that event, Douglas Brinkley published Wheels for the World, Henry Ford, His Company, and a Century of Progress. In his book, Brinkley argues that Henry Ford did not invent the automobile, but his influence and innovations laid the foundation for a company that would put the world in motion and change America forever. Brinkley, professor of history at the University of New Orleans, explains in our commentary of the week.
From Civil War to Cold War, from horse to automobile, from candlelight to electric light, Henry Ford's 83 years spanned an era of fast, sometimes furious change. However, he had done as much as any other individual to shape that change, putting in motion some of the major forces that still affect billions of lives around the world today. Henry Ford, speaking to the Saturday Evening Post, once quipped that our great pioneering has not been in covered wagons, but in laboratories and workshops and in better ways of living as a human society. Historian David L. Lewis described the epic proportions of Ford's accomplishments by saying that the Model T was the log cabin of the motor age. Ford clearly understood the many ways he forced progress to turn its course in originating the universal car, in using productivity as a mean of increasing wealth for all, and in letting the assembly line set the pace of a modern economy. The only thing Henry Ford never understood was the modern world wrought by those changes. He retreated from it, collecting antiques, building a museum, and finally taking long drives through the farmlands of his youth. Tragically, Henry Ford couldn't connect to those people who were themselves products of the modern era he helped instigate. His own son, Edsel, the quintessential 20th century gentleman, had long been a stranger to him. He trusted only old-style men, men carried over from the century before. Although Henry Ford had many days when he couldn't remember faces or events, he was almost always coherent. That is to say, only those close to him recognized that his mind was failing. To a person who had not met him before, he was a mild elderly gentleman making solicitous conversation and offering old-fashioned advice. Except for strangers, family members, and servants, few people saw Ford during his last months. One of those whom he did not see was the man who had claimed to be his most loyal ally. After years of constant communication, Harry Bennett spoke to Henry Ford on just one occasion after leaving the company. He then abruptly refused to see Ford or accept any of their frequent telephone calls. As Henry Ford grew sicker and sicker and was laying on his deathbed, people started analyzing his entire career. Henry Ford had long been a symbol of the American dream. To anyone outside the world of Fairlane, he wasn't the autocratic Ford. He was an unflinching individual who had brought to the tumultuous times he lived in an obstinate way, refusing always to settle into a pattern, but stubbornly he remained convinced that anything is possible at any time and for anybody. For all the failures and the blunders in his personal opinions, it was the soaring success in the middle of Henry Ford's life, the creation of the Ford Motor Company, that was a reflection of what was essential to the man. No one believed more absolutely than he did that an automobile was only an extension of the most old-fashioned man, and few people before him believed more fully in the concept of globalization in business. He considered manufacturing and trading between nations the highest callings of all. The Automobile Hall of Fame in Dearborn correctly states that Henry Ford did not invent the automobile, and notes instead that he is responsible for putting the world on wheels.
You've been listening to Douglas Brinkley, professor of history at the University of New Orleans and the author of Wheels for the World, Henry Ford, His Company, and a Century of Progress. And finally, we leave you once again with more words from the past, never intended to be heard by you. In this third part of our eight-part series, The White House Tapes, we listen to another secret Oval Office recording offered to the public by the New Press. This week, we take you back to January 1955 and a private conversation between President Dwight D. Eisenhower and Senator Walter George. Among the most contentious issues to arise during the early part of Eisenhower's administration was the question of presidential treaty-making powers. Many believed they were too broad and had led the United States into the United Nations-sponsored Korean War, which had proved costly and frustrating. Ohio Senator John Bricker sponsored an amendment to the U.S. Constitution to regulate the president's treaty-making powers. Eisenhower was steadfastly opposed, so on January 7, 1955, he invited Senator George, who was also chairman of the Senate's Foreign Relations Committee and president pro tem of the Senate, to the Oval Office to discuss the matter. George emerged as Eisenhower's ally, and soon thereafter, the measure was defeated. Listen carefully. This was recorded in the Oval Office nearly 50 years ago.
Well, sir, all right, sir. How are you?
I lost that platform yesterday. My name is Tim. I can scarcely stand. You look behind me. I'm pleased. That's all right.
Yeah. I find that when I think things, I get up and I walk around.
If you can walk around, I'll tell you.
You've been listening to President Dwight Eisenhower in an Oval Office conversation with Senator Walter George on January 7, 1955, courtesy of the New Press, publisher of a 9-CD set of presidential recordings and companion book titled White House Tapes. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. We welcome your comments or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.